B-Pod Studios.
Justin Barrasso is the senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He does, at the very least, a weekly wrestling column, but I feel like I see a new story or profile from Justin every day. Justin has been my friend for the last 18 years or so, and I had no idea that Justin was a wrestling fan until early 2013 when he called me asking for input on a Macho Man Randy Savage story that ended up being published. Before that, Justin was a production assistant at WEEI Radio and transitioned to a job that had him working at Fenway Park for the Boston Red Sox and later TD Garden working for the Boston Celtics. Justin also spent time writing for the Boston Herald. Justin and I would sit in a closet in the back of the press box at Fenway and just talk for a few innings, just about life and baseball and all sorts of fun things. Justin has come a long way since being a production assistant and sitting in the back of a Red Sox press box with our random sports conversations. As the Randy Savage story was the launching pad for Justin to become one of the premier wrestling scribes and one of my go-to sources for breaking pro wrestling news and opinion. Justin Barrasso, did I get everything right there?
Wow, that was humbling. But I appreciate it. And the most important part of that to me was the friendship. I don't know if people know that. We go back to 01 or 02, Jim. We go way back because I remember calling you for advice on a Red Sox playoff internship in 2003. But I did back-to-back summers at EEI. So I think we met in the summer of 01. I mean, that's 19 years ago. So, yeah, but thank you for highlighting some of the accomplishments. But it's been a pleasure to get to know you for the past two decades. And see you too, Jim. You've had a great career, midst of a great career as well.
So to mediocre career.
I'll agree to disagree.
If you guys know Red Sox PR people, the PR person at the time was Kevin Shea. So that's how long ago. It was before John Henry took over with the Red Sox as owner of the Red Sox. So that's the time frame that we're talking when Justin and I first got to meet and got to start knowing each other really well.
And I kept that story secret. I never told Kevin Shea who gave me the number. I called him before game one in Oakland. And that was the suicide squeeze. Man, what was his name? D'Orazio. What was his name, Jim? I have to baseball reference that. I used to be able to rattle this stuff off. Was it D'Orazio? His name began with his initials were ED. Was it D'Orazio?
That sounds right. I'm doing the same thing. I'm just going to go to baseball reference.
Yeah. I think I called Ted Sarandis that night after the game. I was so passionate about that. That was a terrible loss. And what an end to the series. The Derek Lowe, the crotch chop, the DX. I mean, a great, one of the best, super biased opinion here. One of the best five game series of all time. Sox going down on 2. Winning those two games at Fenway, Nixon having some big moments. But I saw Kevin.
The cross chop. Oh, my goodness. I forgot about the DX thing.
Yeah. And then I saw Kevin Shea at Kevin Doyle's wedding. And I said, I still can't tell you who gave me the number, but hey, I'm doing this. And thank you for the opportunity. So.
Well, I don't think Kevin Shea is a wrestling fan. So I think, unless somebody else tells him.
Tips him off.
But
probably
say. Okay. What's he going to do now? Call me and yell at me about it?
Right.
I mean,
he said two things. He's like, I don't know who gave you this number, but never call it again. And I think, he gave me one other piece of advice. And he said, if you want the internship or whatever, it was a playoff internship. And, for a junior in college and someone who loved Boston sports and the Red Sox and a chance to work at Fenway and be a part of that run, which ended suddenly before the World Series. But, it was such a thrill. So. Always
it's awesome. I'm so glad that worked out for you too.
Thank you.
I never mind. I need a t-shirt of that.
I know, right?
As I've kind of gotten older, I'm a little bit more like, hey, can I give this person your number as opposed to just giving it out? Because I'm 39 now, and at the time, I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, this is all public knowledge, or this isn't a Red Sox book or something like that. So,
and it's weird that Kevin answered. I think he answered the first ring. He's like, hey, what's up? And I know exactly where I was when I called. I was an undergrad at BC. I can say exactly where I was, how it happened. So but happy to be in the world of wrestling too. And the great thing about covering wrestling is, you know, by and large, whenever you're talking to athletes from the more mainstream pro sports, everyone, I shouldn't say everyone, Jimmy, the vast majority of players want to talk about wrestling some way, shape, or form. So it's really nice that, yeah, I mean, I love covering wrestling. I hope that my whole career is somehow linked to wrestling. And it's been 9 years now. I did some pieces for with the Boston Herald with wrestling, and then worked on that Macho Man story, like you said, too. So, yeah, thrilled to be even a small piece in the wrestling world.
Where did that Macho Man story end up? Was it ESPN? Was it the Herald? Was it Sports Illustrated? Where did that end up? I don't remember.
So it ended up with Sport. We ran it before WrestleMania 31, which is the first time I covered a Mania Live. That was the year that Lanny Poffo was inducted into – excuse me. Lanny Poffo inducted Randy Savage into the Hall of Fame. So we held on to it. And yeah, there were interviews, all kinds. I mean, the Hogan interview was when he was with TNA. Actually, you and I were in that room together.
I know.
Al Snow did stand-up comedy. Hogan was like 90 minutes late for his media session. And that was a fun day. And that was the infamous day when you know, the Jay Stu versus Bully Ray. plus, that day was super awkward because that was like one of the most exciting days for a young journalist, someone who grew up loving wrestling, and you're interviewing these talents. But also very uncomfortable, if you remember, because we were interviewing the wrestlers, like they were cutting us to the front of the line while they were signing. We were getting booed while they were doing their autographs. They would pause for like 10 minutes and do interviews. These poor people are in the line waiting. They've been waiting all morning. They wanted their Jeff Hardy autograph or their Kurt Angle one. It was not a good situation. I think eventually they moved us to the back and we did them there. But I mean, just a crazy thing that we're interviewing guys while the paying public is waiting to get their stuff signed.
Yeah,
good setup.
I didn't like that setup either. And I remember I would always ask for the people who had no line, unless there was a situation like, you know, with Bully Ray and with Taz, we were jumped right to the front for obvious reasons because we were going to be part of the show. Although I'm not sure that we were smartened up to what the show was going to be until after the fact.
There was a show.
Because you were there when Taz cut a vicious promo on me, which it was tremendous.
I think I was talking to Jeff Hardy at the time, and Jeff was – I think Jeff – I asked one question. Jeff answered something totally different. So I'm trying to keep it on track, and out of the corner of my eye, I'm looking and I'm thinking, what is going on behind me right now? And then, like, Bully Ray stands up. I'm like – and then I turned, and it's Jimmy. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So it would have been – it wouldn't have been a good tag team match. Bully Ray and Taz – against Jay Stu and Justin B would have been a one-sided ass whooping, and we wouldn't have come out victorious. So, but I remember hanging out with you in the lobby after, and you being like, "What the hell just happened?" So that was a hell of a day.
It was great because the behind the music story of the Bully Ray situation is he was the Impact TNA champion. He came in and he was in the back room just kind of playing around on his phone, and I'm like, let's do something.
This is at the studio on the radio station,
This is at the studio. This would have been the Tuesday or the Wednesday, and he's in the back room because I'm waiting for the production studio to open up, and I'm like, hey, let's do something, like tag teams of all time, and he's dutzing around on his phone, and he's just kind of like, yeah, we'll do it whatever when we get in there. And the PR person, who I won't stooge off because he's a friend, was like, yeah, do whatever you want. You're fine. So we get in there, and what happened was I was just doing the whole, like, needle him. And then I called him an average athlete, and that was the end of that. Because when he said there, he's like, you've really offended me, this, that, and the other thing. And we went through and promoted the show. And at the end of it, he said to me, which I don't know if I've told this publicly, maybe I have or maybe not. He says to me, 5-10 years ago, I would have knocked you on your ass for that type of comment. Right?
Was that on the air or off the air?
That was off the air. That was as soon as the mics went off.
Nice to know.
And you know, I was apologetic, and sure. I'm like, yeah, I pushed too far. I'm sorry. And they were going to Capitol Grill that day. And I'm like, can I pick up the tab for Capitol Grill? And they go, no, Dixie Carter's going to pay for it. You're good. And
lucky you. That would have been Capitol Grill. I mean, gosh, the appetizers alone would have been pricey. But anyway.
And in the aftermath of that, years later, I had a conversation with the PR person who I'm still friends with, who you're friends with. And he said, yeah, Bully was a little too wound up. I knew what you were doing. You're fine. Don't worry about it. And that podcast got 17,000 downloads in 4 days. And the fun part for me is there was at least a small smattering of average athlete chants at Bully Ray during that main event with Sting when they were fighting in the crowd. So that made my day.
The payoff. I'll still say that show was severely underrated. They should have sold out the Aganis.
No, it was Aganis.
It was Aganis. Yeah, they could have packed in with kids, or I don't know. They could have been a little more creative, but it wasn't a bad show. I mean, they had Kurt Angle, you had AJ Styles, there were a lot of interesting pieces on that show that went on to bigger things. But I don't know. Interesting so time in wrestling, for sure.
Here's the part two of that story. I was promised for doing that and having that situation happen, I was promised front row tickets.
Oh, wow.
And we were going to be close to front row.
What's that?
We were like second to last row in one of the corners.
Probably not a bad thing, though. I don't know what Bully would have done to you if he saw you in the front row. So maybe it worked out for the best.
Oh, I would have sold my ass off for him, because that would have been such a great. Although I don't think that I'd have to sell anything. I think he'd just outright
hit me. It would have hurt. Yeah,
it would have hurt. But it would have been worth it. It would have been worth it because it's fun. It's pro wrestling. Whatever. Like, yeah. I anger a wrestler. He gets to punch me on live pay per view. I mean, that's good business, right?
There's a payoff to it. But that show, I remember that show, there were so many wrestlers. Like Sting was telling Randy Savage stories the morning of. We did something with him. There were so many opportunities there to talk about Randy Savage. And everybody had a Randy Savage story, right? Like Steve Austin had a Randy Savage story from their brief time together in WCW. Just everybody. The only person that I didn't get for that interview that I really wanted to speak with was Roddy Piper, just because they weren't necessarily known for their matches, but they were always on commentary together. And Piper was, if you remember, was on headset during the infamous Jake Roberts snake bite with Savage. So I thought it would have been fun to have Piper. And we did have an interview set up, but he passed away shortly before. So never interviewed Roddy Piper, unfortunately, and would have loved to got his take on Savage. But even like Jesse Ventura, people were really open about it. And I remember before I was a Sports Illustrated, like a cold call, like emailing Scott Hall. I think he posted his emails on like his Twitter account. I mean, the internet was so different 9 years ago, 10 years ago. And he responded to the email and said, if you want to talk about Macho Man, I've got all the time in the world for you. Call me at this number. And to his credit, I called him and we probably spoke for like 15 minutes about Randy Savage. So yeah, it was a really unique piece. Long form wrestling journalism has changed so much over the past decade. So that for me was such a big breakout opportunity. It actually didn't run with Sports Illustrated right away, though, Jim. Not that they didn't want it, but it was too long. It didn't have the right definition. It just didn't have the right order. It got there. Andy Gray, who was with Sports Illustrated, Andy was such a tremendous help to my writing career. He's one of the best editors I've ever worked with. Just a gentleman, a smart, always thinking three steps ahead. But for some reason, the Savage story wasn't where it needed to be. And we opened instead. I said, what about a Bret Hart story? And Andy said to me, Justin, I've just read too many Bret Hart screw job stories. And I said, oh, no, I wouldn't give you my opinion. I would call. Like, I've got Bret's number. We did something with the Herald together. I can mention that story quickly right after. But I've got Bret's number. I've got a decent relationship with him. I'll call him and see if he wants to talk about his opinion of the screw job. Andy said, if you can get him, we'll run it. And the piece, it did. You know, tremendous. Like SIR in their top, I don't know, it was like 20 stories of the year. And I remember Julian Benbow, who's a good friend and Boston Globe writer and a very talented writer and also a great friend. And I remember Julian texting me, I think it was like 2 days before Christmas. And I was at the mall, I was somewhere, something to do with Christmas. Or I was at lunch with my mother. And I remember looking at my phone and Julian being like, this is great. And I'm thinking, what is he talking about? And the piece had done really well, the Bret Hart run. So then we did a Shawn Michaels piece and then it kind of blew up from there. But at the time, Jim, I had the most proud wrestling series, or proudest, you know, series I put together was that Boston Herald. It was WrestleMania 30. I remember pitching Hank Hurwitz on it And I think Hank just thought I had like three heads. I'm pitching him on a WrestleMania series, you know, 3 decades of WrestleMania. Only one was in Boston, and it wasn't the year that it was taking place at WrestleMania 30. But I said, you know, run them in Saturday papers. Run them when we have a thin sports section. Run them online. They'll do really well. It'll be different, and we'll get these big names. And we got, you know, Steve Austin and Bret Hart, who was thrilled because all these guys, I loved Jimmy. I never wanted to leave the Herald. I always thought it would be fun to have every wrestling story. It was just so easy for me because you had an easy tie-in. Can you tell me a Boston Garden story? And even a guy like Steve Austin said his story was, I wish I had a Boston Garden story. You know what I mean? So like in telling him stories about from old timers who said they wrestled at the old garden, like Jim, it was just so much fun with stuff that I can't really do with SI, which is okay. But I love the old, and Brett had tons of cool stories, mainly because of that Survivor Series too, because he's with his dad, he's with his brothers, many of whom are no longer with us. So Brett had some very personal, poignant memories of wrestling at the Garden. So anyways, a long story for a short question, but yeah, the Macho Man piece was a big stepping stone in my wrestling writing career.
One of my favorite things when I do actually talk to actual wrestlers is ask them about their Boston stuff. You know, the lost interview that I did with Mick Foley, that was all Boston centric. That was about him winning the title in Worcester. That was about Rock and Sock Connection. Just so many fun things. And Mick Foley is my all time favorite. You know this. We got to sit and have lunch with Mick a few years ago, I think it was, over at Sports World with Phil Castagnetti, where you were nice enough to bring him Kowloon. And
I think it was he eating lunch, and you and I just, as Mick was chewing, us asking him questions. But it was so much fun. I mean, he's such a great sport, and yeah. It was like the back room. We were in like the back room at Sports
World. We were sitting in Castagnetti's office, and Mick is just chowing down on Kowloon food, and you know, we're just listening to him tell stories when he's not chewing or asking him questions or whatever. Well, Mick's just the best. He's just in general the best.
Oh, yeah. He was in a bind that day because Andy Wong, who's terrific, Andy from the Kowloon, you know, the best restaurant in the world, Andy had lunch for him and they were waiting for Mick. And I think the flight was delayed or the ride got in late, something. So they couldn't get him his lunch. So he needed to do the signing. So it's a weird story, Jim. I may have been there having lunch or I just drove by, one of the two. But I got the call. Do you still want the interview? I said, of course I still want the interview. I'm on my way. Then can you pick me? Can you just go in and grab me the lunch?
Of course
I will. So, I mean, it's tough to do those things when you're hungry. So, yeah, that was a fun day. That was just the three of us. That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole Vince protein bar thing, right? You've heard Bruce talk about the make sure you have a protein bar because when you need to pitch the ideas, you got to make sure Vince is not hungry. He's on some sort. He's eating something because then you've got a shot to get your idea over.
This is a great story. I mean, everybody's got these great Vince stories, but one of the former writers, and he didn't tell, he told me this in private, so I won't say his name, but he gave Vince this pitch on a Raw angle, and Vince said he hated it, and if he ever brought up something like this again, he'd be out of work. He would never work for WWE again. And was it Jericho idea, or Jericho was just invested in the writer's success, and Jericho said, wait an hour and a half. He finishes his ice cream or his dinner and then ice cream at this point and give him the exact same thing. And the kid was like, I'm not giving the exact same thing. I'm going to lose my job. And Jericho's like, listen, I'll put my word on the line, my name on the line and say, if you go in there and pitch this to him, he'll like it. So that story ends, of course, with the young man pitching to Vince and Vince saying, I love it. So, yeah. Good story.
That's classic. Did you, when you were doing the Randy Savage story, is there the proverbial story that you can't attribute to somebody, but that didn't make the cut for it?
No, pretty much everything was even Jim, I'm telling you, now I interviewed him after, but like, Harley Race had some great comments on Randy. The Randy Savage story, In retrospect, and I recognize this as I was conducting the interviews and then writing the piece, but you think of this like sensationalistic, like a headline, like the Bret Hart piece did so well, right? The screw job piece, his feelings. But the Randy Savage piece was different in the sense that it was a chance to talk to people who were out of limelight about someone they cared about. And also, I'll never forget, too, speaking with Lanny Poffo, who was a gentleman throughout the whole process And I pitched him the idea. I said, this piece needs a real personal touch. It needs your mom. It needs, you know, the mother of the Macho Man. And he said, oh, she doesn't do interviews. And she was in her 80s and living in Florida. And I said, I think if, you know, if I'm going to write this piece, I would never take advantage of that phone call. I would never ask cheap questions or look for a cheap hit or something like that. I would be honest and caring in an interview about her deceased son. And he said, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. And a couple of days went by, he called and said, here's her number. Do with it what you will. And that call with Mrs. Poffo, with Judy Poffo, who's since passed, it was, I don't know, Jimmy, 30 minutes, 35 minutes. And it was, I think she was having a cup of tea, I think, or maybe I was too. But it felt like that, like talking with your grandma. And she just told stories about how much she loved her son and how proud she and her husband were of both boys. But I mean, the interview was more about Randy and her perspective on the wrestling success. And again, we weren't talking about the Macho Man. We were talking about her son. And that was such a kind of a wake up call to me early in my journalistic career that these are people you're writing about, which wrestling, that's kind of forgotten about. Because if you're writing about LeBron James, let's say, or Larry Bird, or I don't know, or anybody, right? You know, you're writing about the person, and they play a sport, but you want to cover the person with dignity. Wrestling's this like fine line of character, you know, human element too. So, but it was such a good lesson for me early on to remember that, you know, you got to be careful. You got to treat these interviews right. And so I try to take a lot of pride in that. But that was, to me, the most meaningful interview was the Mrs. Poffo interview. And I'll never forget getting an email from Lanny, and he said, this is from my mother. She can't write an email, but she wanted to say how much she enjoyed, how nervous she was about the call and how much she enjoyed talking about, you know, Randy. So, yeah, even little things too, talking to Mr. Henning, you know, Larry the X before he passed and, you know, him saying little things like, I'm so grateful that I could be, you know, do another interview and things like that too. I think that there's so many opportunities in wrestling and there's so many good wrestling writers out there covering wrestling. I think it's a wonderful field to cover. But to answer that question again, Judy Poffo would be my answer.
So I set up all that background to give you the proper credentialing to say that this was the story that I think got you your Rolodex of numbers to be able to be one of the best, if not the best, wrestling writer out there, because you actually reach out to these people. You're just not making crap up. You're reaching out to people. You're trying to get information and you use the word journalist a lot. And that, I think, is just, it's a dying breed. Like, I'm a gossiping radio producer. Like, I know people, but I don't put them out there. I know that my friend always puts it to me like this. I know enough people to be dangerous. But you actually, you're fortunate enough because you actually get people who will tell you stuff on the record. And that's why I set up all the Macho Man story, I think, set the groundwork to do that, at least in a bigger picture scenario for you.
Thanks. Sometimes too, you know, I do, I think too that I, you know, I never talk about it, but just like my time at the Herald, it was sort of in the, you know, just a unique era in wrestling. Like guys were so willing, I shouldn't say people were willing to give their number, but it was just so early in wrestling coverage. It was different. And there were other people, I wasn't the one breaking ground. There were others doing it too, but, that helped. Yeah. I think the Rolodex has definitely, it's grown in size over the years, which is great. And it's nice to give people a voice and an outlet to speak. It doesn't mean I'm always right. You know, I've got stories wrong before. And I mean, there's two things you can do when you get it wrong, right? You own up and yeah. I made mistakes. And then, you know, you fight really hard to never let that happen again. Because to me, the most important thing is that authenticity between reader and writer. And you've got to have that connection, just like you do on the air at the radio. If somebody's taking the time, especially for me, like on the internet, you can make the same parallel on the radio, but the internet, you could literally read or watch anything you choose. And if you're choosing to click on a story that Justin Barrasso wrote, that means the world. So I don't want to let you down. So thank you, Jim. But I mean, every story is, especially the opportunities to break news, you take a lot of pride in getting it right. So but it's important to make that mistake or two. I'll never forget. It was Mike Johnson, actually. I got a story wrong, and you know, some people, they take pride in seeing others fall. And I don't know if you have a relationship with Mike, but Mike was such a gentleman, and he reached out when he didn't have to and just said, listen, like, you're going to make mistakes, but keep working. Everything, you know, you're on, you know, you Myth, you're wrong on this one. You go on to the next one. And again, I think the world, I think Mike's a terrific, terrific writer and wrestling reporter and journalist. And what he's built is really special with PW Insider. But yeah, thank you. So it's honestly, wrestling's been a whirlwind. And it's so different. You look at the pandemic, Jim, right? Like a lot of sports shut down. Wrestling picked up. So it's quite a world.
If you have $18.5 million, you can be an essential business too. But as far as Mike Johnson goes, I've been a subscriber to PW Insider since, I think, day three. I think they had the Brock Lesnar story on day three of their site launching. And I've been with that site ever since. I met Mike in Chicago at AEW show last Labor Day. I met him at StarCast. He was talking to the world-famous Mary Kayfabe. I don't know if you know Mary at all. She's a huge Ring of Honor fan.
I follow her on Twitter. I know, and she's a big Matt Taven fan. And yeah, but a big fan. I mean, she helped find unearth that videotape, right?
Yep, she unearthed the Bret Hart. Oh, what was the guy's name? Tom McGee tape. That's right. She's trying to get me the Ric Flair Bret Hart Iron Man match from the Boston Garden.
If she can do it, I can't wait to the viewing party. Hopefully we do that at the Kowloon.
I hope so too. Just to wrap up the Randy Savage thing, like if you're talking since 1984, and I just use that marker because I think that's when national TV expanded and wrestling really exploded then. Where's Randy Savage rank? Because I have him in the 5 to 10 range. And I think he has a great resume of in-ring work, the promos. But I think why I put him in that 5 to 10 range is those Slim Jim ads made him a true mainstream star.
Yeah, and if you look at it, you know, from the prism of just his WWF run, so end it when he leaves, it's still pretty special. It's amazing how much he got himself over from the broadcast booth. Like, I think so many of us who are now adult wrestling fans grew up with, at some point, Randy Savage on the broadcast. He made the most of that time. I think, you know, Savage almost has different eras of his career, right? There's the Intercontinental Champion run he had the long robe and the big glasses. And then that kind of peaked when he won the belt, which is such a great story with Hogan, Savage, Andre, DiBiase. It's such a well-told story. Heenan, early on, you know, on the Saturday night's main event, Jesse Ventura and Vince, just every piece working so well together. Yeah, he's definitely top 10, Jim. You know, wrestling's so subjective. I would say top five. Hell, I'd say top three for me. That was one of the fun things, too. I remember it was a San Andreas interview. This goes back to the Randy Savage building that story. And how often am I going to be face-to-face with The Rock? Right? Probably not that often. So I think I got the sign for one last question because it's supposed to be about the movie. And I said, I got to ask you a wrestling question. And he said, of course. And I said, it's about Randy Savage. And I think Dwayne actually told the production assistant we were going over. And he gave a great answer. Randy Savage was just so charismatic. And one of those guys, too, it's funny how much Bret Hart speaks glowingly of Randy. One of those guys, too, that Vince kind of moved on from, Jim. Like, he wasn't a main eventer after WrestleMania 5. He had the Dusty program at WrestleMania 6. And then he was kind of the guy to put over the next guy, right? Like, he wasn't the lead guy any longer. He forced himself, just by being so talented, back in that position. I wish he closed out WrestleMania 8. I love that Flair match. I know with the Warrior coming back, you kind of need to end with Hogan Warrior. But, yeah, Savage is so special. I'd even say top three, personally.
Do you think the Savage, the reason why Savage wasn't on top for longer was because of his size?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And Hulk, too. Like, I think there's some revisionist history, too, whether you like Hulk, you don't like Hulk. He was just such a magnetic force those years. And it was hard. When he was around, it was really hard for someone else to be champion. Like, would Warrior have been a better champion, Jim, if Hogan was away for those months? Like, would he have drawn better? Would he have been the guy if Hulk wasn't around? What was Hulk working?
He came back in July. He came back in July after he dropped the title to Warrior WrestleMania 6.
Right. So what if Warrior had another year on his own? How would business have done? It's hard to say. Savage, too. It's hard to be the guy. when Hulk's lingering, he was just so big and so larger than life. But
well, because
smaller for the time, it made it work is pretty special.
Yeah, I love that Hogan Savage story. I love all the details into it, especially when they go back like 2 weeks before WrestleMania 5 and they just detail like this look here and this hug here. And you've got both sides of the, oh, it's so good. It's just
That's so great. Great match to WrestleMania 5. It's crazy to think we got a Randy Savage crush match at WrestleMania, but we never got a Randy Savage Dick Roberts one. But it did make sense to shift from Savage to Undertaker for Roberts. But yeah, there was so much good Randy Savage. I mean, so much good stuff. I know it's a mixed tag match and it's not, you know, his greatest match of all time, but the story they told and they brought Miss Elizabeth back at WrestleMania 6, like everything Randy Savage did, WrestleMania 7, I mean, that's a tearjerker. Like, that story is the fact that he starts to hold the rope open for Elizabeth. That's a 4-year story payoff. Incredible to think that could happen. I mean, that stuff just doesn't happen anymore. We don't get 4-month storylines anymore, let alone 4-year ones. So, yeah, I am a Randy Savage guy through and through.
Well, and to bring it modern, I think that's the number one story that's been told in my lifetime of watching wrestling, which is since WrestleMania 3. I think the second one is Gargano and Ciampa, and the accidental story that lasted 3 years, 4 years, because of injuries and because of different things happening. I mean, they broke into the company without contracts. They were per night talents, and then they go through the tag team where they were just there to put people over, and then they got over.
Right.
And then it builds to them finally winning the titles and then doing the breakup. And then they're hurt. And then there's the comeback. And then Ciampa steals the title, holds on to it. And then when they're supposed to have the big blow off where Gargano finally gets his win in Brooklyn at WrestleMania 35 weekend, Ciampa gets hurt or they medically disqualify him. And then he's out. So Ciampa has his moment. And then he has to lose it to Adam Cole. And real quick, they do the final.
Doesn't work that Raw stretch, that main roster stretch.
We don't find out about it.
And maybe the match happens. And hopefully he's still safe. But you wonder what if.
Yep. And I know you went down to you did a story for Sports Illustrated on Tommaso Ciampa and his recovery. You know, and Ciampa and I are friendly. We share something. Our daughters are both named Willow.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm a big fan of his work too. And he's just a guy like he just needs to stay healthy for a prolonged period of time because Tommaso Ciampa is a star. And I thought he did a great job with that Karrion Kross loss. Was that in your house?
Yep.
I mean, for him to be a team player and put it, and I know Kross is hurt and it didn't work out the way they'd hoped, but for to put Kross over like that, put Cross in a position to become NXT champion. I thought the whole thing was rushed. I was interested to see how it played out. But again, Cross doesn't look like a killer in that spot without Tommaso Ciampa making him look like $1 million in your house. What was that, springtime?
That sounds right. But the thing about it is, I think the Cross title win was rushed because Vince needed Keith Lee on Raw, and Cross getting injured ruined 6 months of new main events. And now you have the potential that Finn Balor, I don't think he's going to be out for a while. I think he'll work through the broken jaw if he gets the opportunity to, but I'm not sure if they're going to medically disqualify him and then put the title up again. And now,
I've heard that's not the, I haven't written this yet, but I heard that's not the case, but I'm still waiting for a little more verification. But as of right now, everything I've heard, that's not the case. That could change, right? Maybe the recovery is not as smooth, but it's almost like you're cursed to be in that position as NXT champion. But I think they're smart putting the belt on Balor. If your idea on Wednesday night is we're putting AEW against Finn Balor, he's our champ, he's our guy, and Io Shirai is your other champ. You know, those are your two top champions. It's a pretty great, pretty solid foundation.
It really is. And I think with Balor Like, I think of Balor as an NXT, as at the time, the longest reigning NXT champion, more than I do, unfortunately, the first Universal champion, because he got hurt. And then he's in this program with Bobby Lashley that kind of doesn't make sense. And he wins the IC title, but they don't really do anything with him. He's perfect, I think, with the fact that Triple H is running NXT more than Vince is.
It seemed like Vince lost a lot of faith in him. Like, his main roster run was never the same after that Universal title win and the subsequent injury. That Mania, though, in Brooklyn, were you there that night?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, I have a major issue with that Balor match. Like, to me, you know, the Demon is for kids. Like, that's a great, I mean, not just for kids, but like, if you're 10, like, how do you not eat that up? That's a great, great gimmick. That's a great character. That match, I think, was second to last.
That it was second to last, yep.
And it was super late. And if you've got little kids, it's a school night. Maybe your parents or your, you know, your guardians, your grandparents or whomever are kind enough to let, are open to you missing school the next day. But if you're trying to build a young audience, that match has to be on early in the night. Like, what? I'll never understand why the Balor Lashley match, that should have been early in the show. You had Leo Rush, who was that was a good little good program, and Balor and that as that character needed to be on earlier for the younger audience. I thought that was a missed opportunity.
Well, and I if Paul Heyman hadn't advocated for Seth Rollins or Brock to lead off, it would have been third to last. So that might help a little bit.
Brock wasn't sitting through a 4-hour Mania. Brock wanted to go home.
Oh no, not at all. And there's an argument to be made that the real kids moment was Kofi winning the title right before 10 o'clock.
Yeah. And I went outside for that. Bailey Carlin, who's actually was with Sports Illustrated. He was covering the event, like the social media end of it for SI. And he was watching outside, and I was kind of going back and forth just because the press box is nice, but there's nothing like being in a show when you're outdoors and place is packed. And I really wanted to watch the Kofi Bryan match. I wanted to watch the whole thing outside just because you knew the story was so good. It had to be Kofi's moment, or it had to be. And who better to do it with than Daniel Bryan? And that match was spectacular. That place lit up when Kofi won. It's one of the biggest wrestling moments, man, in the last 10 years, Jim, and partially or largely because that whole story, it wasn't like the Mania match was a standalone great match. It was, but it also had that great story behind it.
And that's something that's important with wrestling. We grew up with the wrestling promo and being invested emotionally in characters, mm-hmm. and we're getting all these great 4, 5, 6-star matches. But it's the emotional investment that really puts it to that next level. And in such a short period of time, and I think it was advocated by Daniel Bryan in the background, Kofi just gained so much momentum, and the crowd and the fans are like, yep, let's do Kofi. We're into Kofi. Because that was supposed to be Kevin Owens' spot, if I remember correctly.
And that was, that was just a special moment. I think, you know, it's hard to say which one's better in terms of Daniel Bryan's greatest moment. Was it WrestleMania 30? WWE moments. Was it WrestleMania 30? Was it the moment 4 years later with Kofi? The Kofi moment doesn't mean as much without the Yes run 4 years prior.
Right.
It's kind of like a chicken and egg argument. But, and that all goes back, Jim. That all goes back to the original point, the Randy Savage story. When Randy Savage died in 2011, I remember wanting an outlet to write about it and I wanted more wrestling coverage. When Edge was forced to retire after WrestleMania 29, I remember wanting an outlet to cover that. And I think I was at the Herald then and I pitched that. People were like, why would we cover this? It had nothing to do with local news, right? Or local sports. But I really wanted a voice to have another voice for wrestling. And that covering Kofi was like that. That was one of those moments where it was like, this is incredible. When pro wrestling's done well, when the story's done well, it's incredible.
Do you know one of the things that I've, like, being in radio, and there's a niche audience for wrestling. It's there. And I've learned that from doing this podcast for 175-ish episodes, 150 episodes, or whatever it is. And it's a loyal, good audience. But the metric that I always use is when wrestling is hot, and you would say it was hot in 2006 when it's Red Sox Yankees at Fenway Park. So you've got 38,000 fans there. SummerSlam being headlined by John Cena and Edge, Ric Flair and Mick Foley, the McMahons against DX, and Hogan versus Randy Orton sold out that building. And so wrestling, when it's going well, has that audience there that will put, what is the Garden holds, 14,000, 18,000 for wrestling, something like that, somewhere in between there, against 38,000 for Red Sox Yankees at really one of its peak times. So there's an audience there for wrestling locally. And I've found that out, thankfully, you know, because the podcast numbers are great. They're number one in Beasley, the Beasley Media Group, our parent company of the Sports Hub. So, I mean, there's an audience for it.
Do you think we'll see a SummerSlam at Fenway?
No.
I don't either.
And I think it's a political reason more than it is an actual, like, Fenway Park makes sense for a venue to do a SummerSlam at.
Well, to me, you know, the missed angle of this is WWE's very loyal by and large to their venues, and they've been, yep, they have a long-standing relationship with the Garden. I don't see them. I know you could put the other events at the Garden, but that's kind of a slap in the face, right? We're going to do SmackDown, TakeOver, and Raw with you, but we're doing SummerSlam there. I think that's a tough sell, though it would be. To me, the play is do a TakeOver at Fenway. That way the Garden's happy because they're getting SummerSlam or whatever big event you're doing. But if you're Triple H and you want the most buzz for your product, you should do Fenway. Like, that'd be a great – or AEW. I don't know how AEW would sell. They would need to really market it well, but Fenway would be a great – venue for a wrestling show.
I actually think they should do SummerSlam at Gillette.
Yeah.
But here's the question, Justin. If they do SummerSlam at Gillette, what's the match?
Like, say it were next year. Say it was recent. What's the match that sells? You need Cena.
You need Rock versus Roman, and you need Cena. Hogan doesn't have a match left, right? Hogan's done. I think
so. Yeah. Maybe he makes an appearance, but I think he'd get a good response. But you could do Cena-Roman.
Cena-Roman.
I think that could be – though I like how you had John not in the main spot, but I think you could do Cena-Roman, and that would get the crowd. I think that would draw a lot, especially with – you know, we see so little of John Cena now. I think that would be a really big match.
Oh, I know what it is. Think. Cena-Goldberg.
So I think Cena Roman's the big. If he did it right now, that's still a good one.
But I'm just trying to think of, like,
Cena and Goldberg,
because we should, you know, with Roman's turn and linking with Heyman, there are all these sorts of teasers that, and mostly by The Rock making the comments that, yeah, I'll put Roman over at a WrestleMania. I'll put Roman over in a story. Like, that's fine. So I'll ask you. Do you see The Rock coming back for one more match? And is it WrestleMania in Tampa or Los Angeles or wherever it is in March or April?
I think Rock is WrestleMania or bust. And I think I like what they're doing with this Roman title reign. Like, I like the fact he was using submission finishers against Braun on SmackDown. It's a different angle or different element for him. It makes him even more fearsome in the ring and smarter, and Roman's a beast. He's a monster. I would have Roman go through everybody. And, you know, we were talking about this before we went on the air, Jim, how WWE so often brings back stars at the expense, or legends at the expense of their stars. Like, look at Goldberg, and I know they had to get to WrestleMania, but Goldberg kind of being using Kevin Owens as a wrecking ball, right, to get to WrestleMania as champ against Brock. What was that? That was Orlando, right? That was 33?
Yeah, it was Orlando 33.
Yeah, I mean, I would go the opposite route with this. I would bring back the legends and feed them to Roman. I would have him run through The Undertaker. We talked about that before we went on the air. It'd be such a great moment for Taker to say he wants the belt. And it would sort of tie into the whole documentary in terms of, you know, another match, another opportunity. He wasn't happy with the match with Roman in Orlando. He comes back at full strength. Roman runs through him. I would do the same thing. You could do it with Goldberg if you want. Goldberg doesn't lose a whole lot, but he was willing to lose to Roman at WrestleMania. I don't see why he wouldn't do it again under the right circumstances. I mean, if he's getting paid, right? And then Mania has to be The Rock. I think that's a huge, especially with right or wrong, if they have a packed venue. I don't know what the world, we don't know what the world's going to look like next April, but that would be a really, really dynamic main event, The Rock against Roman Reigns. And what are the Usos doing by then? It's going to be, Jey Uso has been a revelation in the single scene for WWE. So where do they go next? I mean, is he Owen Hart? Owen Hart had a great career post the Bret feud, because I see so many parallels between Bret and Owen and Roman and Jey. But I mean, you can do a lot with Jey. I hope that he stays relevant, you know, either in or around that main event picture for a long time.
Yeah, I kind of see, because if Roman, we assume Roman's going over and he's going to make Jey Uso say I quit. Is I quit enough for Roman? Does he stop after the I quit? Or does he force Jey Uso and then Jimmy Uso to join up with him and they do the supergroup thing?
Which would be a nice wrinkle. And then, I mean, there's so much you can do with Roman. And that's the thing too. Like, look, we go back to Randy Savage. But you have to let these guys evolve. Roman didn't, and I don't think it was his call. Roman wasn't allowed to change for a long time. When Roman went away and he came back, he was able to kind of call his own shots. And he wanted to stay in the character and to make it more realistic. He wanted to work with Paul Heyman, which is a stroke of brilliance because they've been fantastic together. And at the very least, Jimmy, they probably have, I mean, they've got a long time together. I think they'd be fresh for the next year together. It reminds me a lot of, very differently, obviously, but it reminds me a lot of when Paul worked with CM Punk. It was so different than what we'd seen prior to Paul and Brock, because we're so used to the Heyman-Lesnar connection. So it's so different. Same thing here with Roman. It's just so different. Like that promo they cut in the boardroom last week on SmackDown, they are firing on a different cylinder right now, yep. Roman and Heyman. It's fun to watch.
And it's because it's so simple, because they're morphing Roman into a Brock Lesnar-like character. As you saw, he chokes out Braun Strowman. And it's giving Roman a dimension that he's always had, but hasn't really been exploited. Like, I think for a long time, and it wasn't more recently, but There was a span where he's main eventing WrestleManias, and he's the best performer that they have, except people are upset because Daniel Bryan wasn't in the Royal Rumble. Daniel Bryan didn't win the Royal Rumble. There are all these other things that the hardcore fans, the people who are paying the money, aren't loving, and they're being vocal about it. But if you look at the crowds, Roman's still selling all the merchandise. And despite the fact that he's getting booed out of the building at WrestleMania 32 after he beats Hunter for the title, like, there's still a lot of Roman merchandise in that crowd. And so booing Roman kind of became the cool thing to do. But Roman has been a premier performer, and he doesn't get enough credit for carrying a banged up Undertaker through 20 minutes at WrestleMania in Orlando. He doesn't get credit the month before for having, at the time, Braun Strowman's best match and leading him through that. And then after that, he gets paired with AJ Styles, and they kind of go through the progression. Roman doesn't get enough credit for that.
Roman's best promo of all time was the night after that Mania in Orlando.
100%.
And the crowd, obviously, you can't get that right now because the crowd was just so out for blood, but that was a great moment. On a highlight list of Roman Reigns' career, you've got to put that at the top of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why Taker would make so much sense for him now in 2020, because they could even tie into that too, and it would be a very different story with Roman and Taker now than it was 4 years ago.
You know, the other thing with Roman is he's got the football background, so he's tough, right? And so this is a story that was told to me, was that WrestleMania 31 match where Brock just kind of ate him up until the end. Brock got popped in the face and basically told Roman, like, okay, you want to fight? All right, let's fight. And Brock just ate him up. And that's why you see all these close-ups of Roman just kind of like laughing and being like, oh, this is the best you got? This is the best you got? Because Roman's in total, like, I'm fighting back, but I'm kind of in survival mode, because with Brock Lesnar, like, violence and heavy violence is an option, as you saw there. And then I think a very underappreciated match was the WrestleMania 34 match in New Orleans. And that was at the end of an evening, a very long night. And the crowd just, it didn't get what it wanted from AJ and Nakamura.
Correct.
And so now we're at Brock and Roman, and everybody's like, okay, Roman's beating Brock finally.
And even then, Cena Taker, Jimmy, even Cena Taker, and I thought the documentary kind of skirted the issue here a little bit. That match was like 3 minutes and 10 seconds. That match was, there were some disappointments that night. So that was a great night for Charlotte and Asuka, but there were certainly some disappointments that night as well.
That was on, that I think up until the AJ Nakamura match was on pace to be the greatest top to bottom WrestleMania since WrestleMania 17. That's how I felt, and I was in the crowd there, and I was
which
feeling
is still the greatest. It didn't, obviously, but you're right. It had a shot at that point.
But the AJ Nakamura match just seemed like such a disappointment. But that Brock Roman match at the end of the night, and Brock winning, and then there's all this rumors about they changed the finish during the match because it wasn't the crowd response that Vince McMahon wanted. And then you saw the WWE 24 special where Brock throws the belt at Vince McMahon.
Right.
Which I don't know if that was real, if that was work, shoot. I don't know what it was. But the fact
Brock's a businessman. I could tell you what it was. But yeah, yeah.
And that I feel like as long as the check comes in, Brock will do whatever you want. And if Brock really likes you, he'll sell his ass off for you. And you've seen that when he's gone in the ring with Rey Mysterio and with AJ and with Daniel Bryan, with these smaller guys. And Seth Rollins, too. He made Seth Rollins look really good. Look at what he did for Drew McIntyre.
As opposed to, compare any of those, Jimmy, with Jon Moxley, the Dean Ambrose match, which I remember being extremely excited for that match.
Same.
On paper, and just everything that Dean Ambrose had built at that point, everything Lesnar, Lesnar was an icon at that point. That is such a missed opportunity. That's on my all time. I mean, I don't have an all time list of biggest WrestleMania disappointments. If I did, that's high on that list. That was such a disappointment. I think Moxley's stuff's great, but that was a mate for both those guys. And it'd be fun to see that ever happen again. Probably won't happen in AEW, but I think Moxley's great. I think Brock knows his character inside and out. So clearly there was a disconnect there.
But it was fun because I was fortunate enough to be at the WrestleMania after party in New Orleans. And that was what everybody was talking about was they changed the finish in the middle of the match. And this happened, Brock threw the belt at Vince. And I'm like, oh my God, if this is legit, this is tremendous. If it's just, throwing working punches, throwing working belts, it's still a great story. Yeah. Like it's supposedly Brock's last night in the company, and Vince puts him over and doesn't tell Brock before the match. He tells him during the match. Like, oh, that's sometimes the best stories are the ones behind the curtain. And sometimes
I agree with you. Yeah. Absolutely. And Mania in New Orleans is like a match made in heaven.
It's awesome.
It's so perfect.
Do you think, I want to ask you a few AEW questions, but sure. While we're talking about Roman, the Roman made a comment about CM Punk a couple weeks ago. Do you think CM Punk's ever going to work again in a wrestling ring?
I don't think so. I mean, it's telling that his comeback was on a studio show. And in Roman's defense or in Joe's defense or a Roman's defense, Roman was asked that question and answered it. I thought he gave a very good answer because, again, Joe didn't answer that question. Roman Reigns did. So I thought he gave a really, really good answer. He didn't like him. And would he work with him? Maybe, if the circumstances were right. I don't think we see Punk back. I still don't. I don't know. I mean, I don't think it'll happen in AEW either. Maybe in a couple of years, but is there a shelf life on a return? I don't know. I just thought it was telling that the big Punk reveal was, especially for signing with Fox. Jimmy, how was that not on a SmackDown on Fox? Just do it there and say, have him come out. I mean, and then you'll see him again the next week on backstage. I was surprised they handled it that way. I think that's telling about the relationship.
I think it's more, and this is from CM Punk doing the interview at StarCast with Mike Johnson from PW Insider.
Fantastic, by the way.
I think, oh, it was fabulous. It was absolutely fabulous. And I got to interact with Punk later on that day, and he's first class. I like the guy. I get along with the guy. But what I'll tell you is I think that he, when the ending in WWE happened, he gets fired on his wedding day. He goes through the legal process after he comes back from his honeymoon. He does the podcast with
the paperwork. Jimmy, was just a clerical mistake, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Say you purposely, I was spiteful and I wanted to stick it to him on his wedding. I'd respect that more than the BS line he gave to Austin that night. Give me good question by Steve, by the way, but give me a break.
Yeah.
Of course he fired him on his wedding day.
Yeah, of course he did. And I bet it was, good job. I think that was more Hunter kind of giving Vince the elbow. Like, we need to process this paperwork, because remember, Hunter came out of retirement when CM Punk was the hottest thing in wrestling, just to beat him on a random pay-per-view. And then he went back into retirement.
Right after. Throwing a wet blanket on the hottest act in wrestling. It's such a weird time. And those Raws, you don't get that type of anticipation. When Punk and Triple H were in the ring together, there was a genuine tension.
Yeah.
Clearly the WWE didn't appreciate. But, I mean, it was fun to watch.
But I think after all that happened, I think getting fired on his wedding day, coming back from his honeymoon, going through the legal process, doing the podcast with Colt Cabana, and then trying MMA and making money at MMA, but not really winning, not really competing, I think, at the level he anticipated he was going to. I think he thought he was going to be a lot more competitive than he was. And he got in there and he got punched in the face and that was it. But I think he mentally closed the door on wrestling once he went to MMA and once he didn't succeed on it. And this is just me reading into it, because I think what he figured out was he had some mental health issues. And if he goes back to wrestling, do those mental health issues come back to him? Research. And I think there's a bigger, deeper thought process to him.
I think Punk will be interesting. And it depends on where they are too. But I think if Punk ever comes back, it is a program. He probably wins the belt ahead of time and then drops it back at Wrestle Kingdom to Okada. I think that if we ever see Punk again, it'll be a program in New Japan where he wins the IWGP heavyweight title. And ultimately he's used to put over Kazuchika Okada. That's my take. Or another New Japan star, but Okada's their guy and he should be. Okada's brilliant and he's incredible and he's one of the best in the world. That to me is, and that's something that to say you main evented the Tokyo Dome, I think is a pretty special thing. If you're CM Punk, particularly after leaving wrestling for a while, those dome shows are red hot. I mean, they're action packed. It would be that'd be a feather in the cap of CM Punk to headline Wrestle Kingdom. And to work with Okada. And you imagine, Jim, he wins the belt like in November or September, works a couple tours and then defends the belt on January 4th. So that to me is something I could see someday happening, but I agree. I don't see the WWE return happening anytime soon.
There's a lot of detail in that. You might be telling us some informed opinion making there, but I will say if he does the Tokyo Dome and it's Wrestle Kingdom, that's his WrestleMania.
100%.
And he gets to check the box that he main evented a WrestleMania,
and not Coleman, not main evented the first night. Like there's only one, and I'm with Punk on this one. His big thing was there's not two main events. There's one main event. It's the last match of the night, and that's what I'm with you, Jimmy, 100%. That would be the moment where he'd be placed. I agree. I don't think he comes back for anything less, and a boatload of money.
But you are in a main event. You're in a main event with Triple H. Yeah, it would have opened the show.
Right. And you wonder that's a great what if. Like, what happens? You know, I have many frustrations, and that being said, I enjoyed the hell out of it. The Michael Jordan, The Last Dance Bulls documentary series. But like the idea that, and I get it, it's Jordan's perspective of the truth we watched. But like, what happens if if Len Bias, and you have Bird interviews in this too, like if Lenny Bias is it lives and plays with the Celtics, what happens to the Pistons? What happens to the Bulls? I assume the 90s Bulls are probably fine because Bird and McHale eventually have to break down. But so much happens. How many titles does Jordan win? Just odd that Len Bias was never mentioned, especially when they went into NBA history a little bit in the 80s. But same thing, too. What happens to Bryan? What happens to Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 30 if Punk doesn't leave the company?
Sheamus.
Imagine. I mean, that, like, Jimmy, and I'm super biased to New England in general, but it was the Providence Raw where they scrapped the whole Bryan Wyatt feud, right? That was the cage match. He leaves the Wyatt family, clearly rushed the storyline because they needed to get out of it to put Bryan on the main event picture. That crowd was just indicative of the entire Daniel Bryan scene. Mm-hmm. It was exploding. And it's kind of neat that it happened in New England. And Jimmy, it happened in Rhode Island. Like, it happened in our backyard. I love that story.
Yeah, and Punk tweeted out the original WrestleMania 30 card because he found it in his basement. It was him versus Triple H. It was Orton versus Batista, and it was Daniel Bryan against Sheamus.
Sheamus, yeah.
Sheamus, no, you want Sheamus on the cover of that video game. Oh, I used to, until it became unavailable, I used to listen to that Colt Cabana CM Punk podcast at least like, you know, twice a year. So I know it pretty well because I'm a huge CM Punk honk. I think he's tremendous. I think he is one of the nicer people that I've ever interacted with. And I think the problem with Punk overall is he tells it like it is, or at least like he sees it. Mm-hmm. And I think people can't necessarily always handle that. And I think that's kind of why he gets a bad rap.
Punk headlining a Wrestle Kingdom show would be major business.
Oh, of course major. It would. And I wonder if that would outdo the Chris Jericho. Because remember when Chris Jericho did that match with Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom? Yep. And Chris Jericho got paid a percentage of how many U.S. buys there were to New Japan World. Or at least that's, I think that's what he said on his podcast. So I wonder if CM Punk would break that record.
If done right in the main event, I think you'd have to make Punk your champion, right? You wouldn't have him challenge and lose. Like, you got to give him a little, even if it's a short run. Have him win the belt in September or October or even November. And then you know, you go with a huge main event. Or in the summer would even be fun, too. I mean, like, an extended stretch of Punk in New Japan would be, I mean, so much fun to watch. So, and even the few matches they could have, it'd be huge business. Yeah, I think it would outdo what Jericho and Omega did, personally.
Yeah, I do, too. And I think just Okada's fabulous. And it, you know, as good as Okada is, so I'm a big Kenny Omega fan. And there, a good friend of mine said Kenny Omega so far in AEW has been Jerry Lynn, which I pointed out Jerry Lynn didn't have as many wins in ECW as Kenny Omega does currently, because I think he's got the most wins in AEW since they started keeping track of wins. Just kind of a general thought on Kenny Omega and, you know, where you think his story might be going, because I tend to think that he's going to win this tournament for a shot at the AEW title, and then they're going to have the match in February where he's challenging, whether it be Moxley or whether it be somebody else.
Yeah, I'm with you. A couple things. I think if you're analyzing the work of Kenny Omega, I think it's important to put him right next to Cody Rhodes. You got to compare the two. They're both EVPs. They worked that match at the Cow Palace a couple of summers ago for New Japan. The Bullet Club is fine, and that was the Tama Tonga night. When the Bullet Club kind of dispersed, went in two different directions. I think you need to compare the two. You start there. And Cody has done a much better job of presenting himself as a main eventer. Now, granted, he hasn't been world champ, but Cody has been a key talent. Let's just look on screen for AEW. Cody Rhodes has been pivotal to their success. And I think right now he's a bigger star than Kenny Omega. You could argue that that Cody was always a bigger star in the States just because of the WWE pedigree. He's the son of Dusty Rhodes. I mean, there's a lot of history to Cody Rhodes in the U.S. wrestling scene. With that being said, Cody's done better than Kenny. I actually think Kenny is exactly where he wants to be. He worked tag stuff. He integrated himself into the American wrestling scene. He's a known commodity now. He worked, a couple of main events for AEW. He's worked, two pay-per-view main events, the Moxley match and the Jericho match?
Moxley match, Jericho match, the Stadium Stampede match. And, for what is critically acclaimed as one of the best tag team matches in history with the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega and Adam Hangman Page from the February pay-per-view.
Which wasn't even as good as the Omega Ibushi Bucks match, but I digress. And that match was fantastic. I'm a huge Kenny Omega fan, but I think he's exactly.
I need them. I need them because I feel like I'm on an island unto myself as far as Kenny Omega in the States.
So much of Kenny's story is right. Tyson Smith, what do you want to call him? Kenny was a goalie in hockey. They're just a different breed of guys. It's not an insult. It's a fact. A hockey player mentality, especially for a goalie. Kenny works best when he is an underdog. And the fact that Kenny Omega came into uncharted territory in AEW as a favorite, you could see it was different for him. And Kenny had so many goals to kind of introduce himself and show different pieces of his wrestling repertoire. He is now he's on the precipice of exploding. That's the biggest star AEW has right now. The biggest emerging star is Kenny Omega. And you might say, well, he's already been there. Yeah, but we haven't seen the Kenny Omega we're about to see. When he wins this tournament, which I believe he will, he's going to make Hangman look like $1 million, but he's going to look special too. He's the guy to dethrone John Moxley. It goes back to the original feud from Moxley's debut. He wasn't coming after Jericho. He was coming after Omega. Kenny shows a different side of himself. He's almost, Jimmy, like a horse race that's been circling and just waiting to explode at the end. We're about to see, at least in AEW, the best we've seen of Kenny Omega yet. Not even close. I can't wait to see it. I think people are going to say, wow, that's the Kenny Omega I wanted to see all along. I really think Kenny wanted to work this program and do it his way. He wanted to work tags. He wanted to build Hangman. He wanted to work. I mean, I just think Kenny, he worked the Pac story. Like, Kenny's a unique breed, and he's got, just like Cody has his own vision of wrestling, Kenny has his. And I'm really excited to see how it pays off. I think that'll be a great match, pay-per-view, Hangman and Omega. And I'm with you. I think he is the guy probably in February because they want to build that up and make that a program. I think that's the payoff in February. Kenny Omega is your next AEW champion. I just can't see Moxley losing it before that.
I had thought that Jericho was going to have it and Kenny Omega was going to beat Jericho for the AEW title. And thank you for that long thing about Kenny Omega. I've needed as much Kenny Omega support as possible. And so you laying that out is great because I don't feel like I'm on an island unto myself anymore. So anybody who thinks he's... Yes, exactly. Like, I'm in for that.
I'm also a Jerry Lynn fan. So, like, hey, come on. Kenny Omega is not Jerry Lynn. I don't know who that was, but I'm happy to speak with him, Jim.
It's a good friend of mine, and I think he meant it as harmless ribbing, just to kind of break my chops a little bit, which is fine. I need more people to do that, quite frankly. I think it's because I wasn't really a Jerry Lynn guy. Because there's just something missing to that package.
And help make Van Damme special. He was the perfect guy across from, like, the one thing he was in the perfect spot. RVD and Jerry Lynn were a match made in heaven, especially for RVD, right? Like, it was the guy he needed.
Yeah. I think Kenny Omega is so much better than Jerry Lynn, but that's neither here nor there.
Oh, not even close. He was the IWGP heavyweight champion. He had a great run. It would have been interesting to see. And that match doesn't get talked about enough, Jimmy. That match is one of my favorite matches of all time when he drops the belt to Tanahashi. Two of my favorites, wrestlers, just purely wrestling, not guys to cover necessarily or any, just in the ring, bell to bell, Tanahashi and Omega. That match, because Kenny left, it's not one that New Japan's going to highlight, but necessarily. But that match was so, the story behind it was, everything about that was peak storytelling, and the match was physical, and I'm with you on that 100%. Kenny Omega is about to blow people away in AEW.
Well, and also with that whole show, that was the changing of New Japan's direction because they were losing all these guys to AEW.
Correct.
And so I think what happens, and I want to talk about the Young Bucks, because I think there's some similarities in what they have done. And I've been critical of how AEW has used the Young Bucks. I think that they should have been the tag team champions right off the shoot, but we'll talk about that in a second. That whole Wrestle Kingdom card is, I think, forgotten about because it's New Japan losing all these stars and there's all these title switches, and there's this entire reset of this promotion, and that show just top to bottom is just so strong.
And it is a changing of the guard in New Japan for sure. It seems like every 4 years that or so that happens in New Japan, that was the most recent one.
So it gets lost because, you know, Jericho drops his title, Omega drops his title. There's too much to digest because they have to push a reset button because they have to what's the word I'm looking for? They have to kind of, but the Young Bucks. So I feel like that the Young Bucks had enough buzz where they should have won the tag team title tournaments, and they have been I don't know if underutilized is the right word, but I've been critical of the fact that they haven't won more than they have. Now, this direction of the Young Bucks, where they're these edgy heels, I like, and you saw some of that in the February tag team match that I saw, where I think they're going to blow doors on FTR whenever they get that tag team title match. And that's the right move. But just what do you think about the Young Bucks and how they've been since their AEW debut?
I think I'm with you. I actually originally thought I would have made them the focal point of the tag division as champions. It's not the direction they went. I think you can argue that. I do think, though, if it's the same thing with Kenny, if you go with kind of the elite storyline of putting Kenny in the Bucks and letting them run through the company, just the three of them. Don't overdo it. Don't put extra guys in. Just make those three the three best in the world. And that's kind of when they struck gold the first time with New Japan. It carried over to Ring of Honor with Kenny in the Bucks. I would run that and milk that. I'd Casey Jones that. You know, run that play over and over again until it doesn't work anymore. I think that would be a very successful move for AEW, making the Bucks your heel tag champs, Kenny your heel champion, and aligning them all together. I think that's where the money is for AEW. Yeah, the Bucks, I actually would have done the same thing, Jim. I would have started them as tag champs. They're the same. They're very similar to Kenny, though. Like, they're also not used to being the favorites. They've always been the underdog as well. It's interesting now they're EDPs, so it's tough to put yourself over in that spot. Was it Rich Eisen who said to Cody the other day during the interview, it must be nice to, you know, wrestle when you can make yourself win the belt every time? Something like that. I'm paraphrasing, but it's true, right? So I think they've been conscientious. They've wanted to build people around them has been their philosophy. And I don't know. If I'm Jericho, it's interesting you mentioned Jericho too. I don't know what you do with Jericho. I think they're probably waiting on to see what happens to Tyson in November. Like, how does that fight go? What's the buzz with Tyson? What does he do next? Because that makes sense for February, Tyson Jericho.
Well, so according to Jericho, Tyson was supposed to do the last pay-per-view.
Correct.
And they couldn't figure out the details of it. I feel like Jericho is the biggest star in AEW. And
for now,
And I think he needed to be because of, you know, all the time that he had in the business and everything. I think one of the reasons why they had him drop the championship to, I got to use my WWE verbiage here. It's a championship, pal. It's not a belt, even though Vince always said belt on TV. Jericho dropping the belt early, I think, was a surprise. And to Moxley, I think it was a little bit of a surprise, although now finding out what a honk Tony Khan seemingly is for John Moxley, I now have a better understanding of it. But I think Jericho realized that at his age, he can't, and I don't think he feels like he should be going wrestling every week or doing all that, you know, make his matches more special.
He needs to be more of an attraction. I agree.
More of an attraction than every week he's on TV. He's telling the world how great he is. But when he gets in the ring, he can kind of do it, but it's more kind of hit or miss. And I think he also realized, okay, I'm the champion. I got this new TV deal for this company. So this company's solid for 3-4 years now. And thank God they got that TV deal when they did, because they may not have lasted through the pandemic. And so now I've done what I can to get them some mainstream. I'm going to help other people get over. And I think that Orange Cassidy program is a good example. I think if they go that direction with MJF, which it looks like they're going to, where the MJF Jericho interplay has been tremendous.
Yeah, so much fun.
And I think that Jericho can be that guy where he's working with the younger guys. And then, oh, here comes Mike Tyson. Oh, here comes Conor McGregor. And I'm just throwing his name out there because it seems like there's always some sort of buzz of him doing crossover stuff.
The Cody Jericho feud can't be done. There's more to be told there. And I would make that a 3-chapter story. I just think I don't think Cody needs the TNT championship. I wouldn't have Cody with that belt. I don't know. I think that's more of guys like Darby Allin or Brian Cage, or I don't know. It's a chance to make somebody else, which we saw with Brody Lee. It was such a fun title run. I'd actually have Cody drop the belt to Jericho and just make Jericho that constant thorn in Cody Rhodes' side, and then have Jericho drop the belt to whomever, right? Orange Cassidy. MJF should probably keep going for the world title. Whomever, though, they need new – you know, that TNT belt is an opportunity for them to really diversify their champions and show some new faces with gold. So, but I like Jericho and Cody together. You want to be careful how often you go to the well. But, that's the great thing about Jericho, though. He's so versatile. And you can put him on the broadcast booth, and you can do so much with him. And I do think, Jimmy, at some point, I don't know if it would sell nationally or globally, but would a Dustin Rhodes world title run make sense? Would people buy in? He's a great story. And unlike Cody, he had a very different relationship with his father. He had the whole Gold Dust run that really put him on the map. Dustin was the next big thing, and he's the perfect size, and he looks great now. And I wonder if there is any interest in a even short run of Dustin with the belt. Maybe not, but it he's just got a great story.
I think if he gets it, he's either got to get it off of Cody, or he's got to drop it to Cody.
One of the two.
Or it's got to involve Cody somehow, because
I agree.
See, I think that when Cody – I think Cody was the TNT champion because he is using that to work with Eddie Kingston. He's using that to work with Darby Allin. He's using that as a way to focus, hey, Orange Cassidy this past week. He's going to work with everybody and be like Jungle Boy. And he's going to work with people and be like, okay, this guy can go. This guy can really go. This guy can actually go. He's going to use that as a testing ground, even though he doesn't need the title to use it. But the story that was told to me was he pitched the idea to the TNT executives and to Tony Khan. And they were initially like, I don't know. And then they circled back to it and eventually came up with it.
They cut Lance Archer's legs out from underneath his knees. I don't know why you don't bring Archer in, and he should destroy everyone till he gets to Moxley. And that's the payoff money match, which is the direction they went. But now, and you know, I think Archer's great, and he's such a modern big guy, and he can fly, and he's a powerhouse. And but it's tough when, like, your first two big programs, you lost in both. So, and I know it's not all about wins and losses, but there's a reason we raise somebody's hand after they win. You don't when you lose. I wish the Archer thing built up straight to Moxley, and then you could have him do a Cody feud. But it's hard when you lose that you don't win the TNT title, and then you're going for the world title.
Wait a minute. AEW wins and losses do matter. I see a grid every week that says how many wins somebody has.
It's hard. It's our fault for applying logic to pro wrestling. But Archer Moxley should have been the from the beginning, because they had the history in Japan, and that's what makes AEW so special, right? Like you can reference Jim Ross can, or Excalibur or Tony Schiavone can reference Japan. They can talk about what happened in New Japan Wrestling, where in WWE, the only thing that happens is in their universe. So it's different in AEW. I would have gone straight to Archer Moxley.
I think there's a big New Japan is so interesting, and I'm so glad we talked about New Japan, is because I think that their relationship is very important with who they have relationships with in the States, and whether that's AEW, whether that's Impact, whether that's Ring of Honor. I think their relationship, once we get into some sort of, once we get out of the pandemic, is could potentially make or break companies, you know, and specifically Ring of Honor, because it seems like somebody has disrespected New Japan like every 10 years. So like WWF did, then WCW did. Ring of Honor seems to have. Impact definitely did.
Yeah.
So like, so when do we get to the point where AEW is disrespecting New Japan and then they're left with what, PWG maybe?
I remember when it was, I was doing a slate of New Japan interviews, and a lot of them were through a translator. And because the talent weren't totally fluent in English, and I'm not totally fluent in Japanese, so I speak very little Japanese. So, but I wanted to ask Okada Impact questions, and I remember arguing with the translator who was saying, "We're not talking about Impact." And I said, "Well, ask him." And like, if he doesn't want to talk about it, if he says, "You know, I'm not giving you a comment," it's different coming from Okada, right? Than it is
right.
The translator. And I remember just, it was like a comedy scene going back and forth of me saying, well, can we let him say that he'd prefer not to talk about Impact? And I think he may have said something in English, like he'd answered the question. But I know that New Japan was very disappointed in the way some of their emerging stars were used in TNA, Okada and being the prime example.
Yeah.
They haven't forgotten.
No, they have very long memories. And you know, being Irish myself, I respect holding grudges forever. Do you think Cody, like, what would be your evaluation of Cody in AEW, both in the ring and you seem to think, how do I say this? It feels like you think Cody's the number one star in AEW. Is that fair to say?
He's right there. I mean, I think the pay-per-view took a hit without him on it, the last show. And I still wonder. It's Tony Khan's company, but they obviously mishandled the Matt Hardy head injury, letting him re-engage in that match and climbing a huge scaffold, light post, whatever it was. Yeah, like, is that different with Cody there, or does Cody take the mentality of? Next interview with Cody Rhodes, I'll ask: is it different if he's there that night? Does Cody take the wrestler approach of, like, once the match starts, you let a wrestler finish? Does he make sure that match ends? Because the optics of it was, thankfully, Matt Hardy was okay. It still didn't look good. I mean, there was, what a terrible spot.
I lost my mind on this because I love Matt Hardy, and Matt Hardy has been super nice to me over the years because he's a super great person, or at least he has been to me.
He's a professional. And what a shame, Jimmy, if his career ended on that spot. And it could have. I mean, that wasn't that far. It's the head. It's the brain. I mean, like, that was a terrible, foolish spot. And can I compare it real quick? I want to hear what you're saying.
Sure.
I want to compare it real quick to the Sheamus Big E match. And I just did an interview with Sheamus, and I thought it was fun to share. I'm grateful to share a piece of his story. That was a very physical, that Falls Count Anywhere match last week on SmackDown. A very physical match that I thought showed Big E should be in the main event, right? And that was Sheamus talked about. He said that he wanted to kind of show off himself as kind of this dastardly heel, but he wanted to show that Big E, yes, he can have fun and crack you up and make you laugh, but if there's a fight, he'll beat you and he can win a fight. So I think that match served. And I remember watching, and I watched a couple times doing the interview, you wanted to do prep, and rewatching the match. What can I find that's different? What can I find that hasn't been asked? And in that match, they're doing the spots in the cars. He does white noise in the car again. Biggie's in the trunk. They're going back and forth in the cars. If you remember, Big E does his finisher off the car onto the table, which is on concrete. And I thought, man, what a foolish spot to do it on concrete, right? Like, what's the point? And granted, they had two tables set up, but WWE was smart, and the cameras kind of had to get it because when the referee's counting, you have to see his hand hit the floor.
Right.
It's on padding. They didn't do that spot. They did the two tables. They did it on the padding. And if you got an issue with that, you get an issue with that. But if you're worried about wrestler safety on a television show, like, there should be no issue at all. Like, that's great. The spot still looked awesome. They did it as safely as possible, and a guy wasn't potentially hitting his head off, bouncing his head off concrete. The tough part to me about that Hardy match was, and we're officially off track now, but that wasn't even the finish.
I know.
Right? Like, that was early in the match. It was just another spot. Like, almost ended his career on just another spot. And I'm with you. Matt Hardy's a legend in wrestling.
And I felt bad because Aubrey Edwards did everything right in that situation.
Everything.
And she got no support. She got no support from anybody. Like, the doctor came over on the third time she threw up the X, or realized, you know, finally the doctor came over the third time that Aubrey Edwards was like, we need a doctor here. Like, I'm telling you, this isn't right. And then the match continued. And it just blew my mind because, like, Aubrey Edwards was on the spot, got there, and was like, we're done here. Yeah. And tried to stop it three times and did not get any support. So I feel for her. I feel bad about that. Like, she did everything right.
That's a great end. You're absolutely right. And that's the match, too. If they stop it where they should have stopped it, like, that's a cool, as long as he's okay, obviously. You stop the match. Everybody, it's not what you want on pay-per-view, but it is what it is. When that match happens, like, it main event's a Dynamite or it's not a pay-per-view, whatever, and Matt Hardy finally gets his revenge against Sammy Guevara, it's a great moment. Like, instead of rushing the match, nobody's going to care about the finish. You're not going to be focused on the finish. Yeah, the whole thing was, you could see it was a moment. It was a tough moment. So my point about Cody was, I wonder if it's different if he's there, because Cody is such an integral voice for AEW. It's hard to picture. It's impossible to picture that company without him. On screen, off screen. In terms of his on screen work, I do think he's one of their biggest stars. I thought it showed that night at that pay per view. No Cody hurts, right? They need Cody as part of the show. His Brody Lee stuff was the night he dropped the belt was really good. He sold that injury so well, sold the loss so well. Cody and Cody's build to the world title, however they do it, Jim, I think you and I both know he'll be world champion there at some point, will be a special moment. Cody's smart. Cody's one of the smartest guys in wrestling. He knows how to utilize it. He knows how to get himself over. I'm excited. I can't picture AEW without them. And I do think if he's not their biggest star, he's right there with Jericho. And again, he has the name too, right? The Road. I know he doesn't use it, but he's Cody Rhodes. He's the son of Dusty Rhodes. He's a WWE star. I do think Cody is so critical to their success. And it was apparent when he was off television. But I just don't think he needs the belt. I think you make Cody more of an attraction, but I get your point though, right? Like he's it's funny. Everybody loves the weekly open challenge. Like Cena kind of perfected it, but Eddie Edwards was doing it in Impact for a little while before he dropped the belt. Cody was doing it. It's different, but I don't think Cody needs it personally.
So I think that the story for Cody is, and I think Cody's been their number two biggest star. I think Jericho's one. I think Cody's two.
I agree.
But I think the play for Cody, and I thought that they were going to do it when he came out with the dark hair and the better attitude, and they just put the TNT title back on him for his revenge. I think the play for Cody is he goes full out villain. Everybody knows he's a VIP. Everybody knows he's a VP, and he just goes into Tony Khan's office and says, "I've signed away the stipulation that I lost to Jericho. That no longer exists." John Moxley said after the show in February when he won the world title that he didn't care that Cody couldn't fight for the world title. So they waive the stipulation. Cody comes in, cheats the entire match, wins the world title, and goes on this arrogant, selfish heavyweight title run. And that's where you can implement Dustin into it. Dustin's trying to reason with him. Cody, this isn't how you want to be. And Cody does the whole, like, this is my company. This is my world championship. I want to represent it as the face. And then you can have Cody beat Jericho. You can have Cody beat his brother Dustin, make it personal. And that's Cody's villain run. And he can really be the American Nightmare.
Jericho would be a babyface, too. We haven't seen that yet. Right. That'd be a fun feud when they flip the roles, right?
Yep. And that's what I would do with Cody.
I like that a lot. I wonder if you look at Cody's world title runs in Ring of Honor, which happened in – that was in Lowell, I believe, right?
Yep, it was in Lowell, yep.
And then we were – actually, I think we were there for both nights he won the belt, right? Then he won the NWA title against Nick Aldis. Were you there? Yep. You were there that night too, weren't you, in Chicago?
No, I wasn't at that Chicago show, but I watched it. I watched it on – I might have watched it on Honor Club, actually.
That's what I picture with Cody, more of the heroic win like he did in his last two title runs, but – I mean, you could say third time's a charm, or you could say, you know, be something different. I'll be curious if Cody's a villain and kind of takes that, the what the internet might think is him getting whatever he wants and playing that to his advantage. That's a money idea, Jim. I agree. I think that'd be a lot of fun. Interesting if Kenny goes that route first, what they'll do with Cody. But I agree, it's time for some sort of change or next step in the development with Cody. I'm excited to see, that match with Darby, the Orange Cassidy match. I liked that it was a – you can't go to the well too often on the time limit draws. That was a good use of it, though. But, yeah, there's a lot of talent on that roster, and I don't think the answer is adding more belts. And it's tough, too, when you hotshot a belt and you have four different guys wear it in 6 weeks. But I think they've got to find a happy medium of using that TNT championship to highlight some new stars.
And I love Taz. Taz is one of my all-time favorites. I was so disappointed when they brought back the FTW belt and he just handed it to
Brian Cage.
Brian Cage. I almost called him Nicolas Cage, like the movie star. But he just handed it to him, and he got crap on social media for it. He's like, well, the FTW belt is a mentality. Well, I remember, because I'm a huge ECW honk, and the FTW belt was just that. I should be the world champion. F anybody who doesn't believe I'm the world champion. I made Shane Douglas. I beat up Shane Douglas. I made him tap out. He can't even defend the title because he's injured. So he was essentially the interim world champion with this FTW belt. And that was what made it so great, as opposed to, oh, well, FTW is a mentality.
Right. Little more history, especially.
It needed, yeah.
Yeah. And it would have been nice if they were touring, which it's a pandemic, but like to be, have a show, right, and have a shot in Philly and have Shane Douglas there. Jim, were you at the ECW show? It was at Champs Arena. I want to say November of, like, it was winter of 96. My father and I still talk about it. It was the first time we'd seen ECW live. My dad had always been taking my brother and I to wrestling shows, and we'd been seeing wrestling at Champs Arena. It was like big time wrestling with Big City Mike, but there was not, or, you know, Tony Rumble, the Boston Mad Boy. There was nothing like, I think they both passed away, unfortunately, Big City Mike and Tony Rumble, but there was nothing we were used to WWE or, you know, WWF or WCW or the independent shows we'd see, and, you know, in local high schools and things like that. When we saw ECW that night, it was my father and I, and they came in the crowd. It was a Public Enemy Dudley's match, and they sold. I remember when they walked in, I'm like, Dad, look at this. They were selling like Public Enemy pots and, you know, or like a pan, and you could knock the hell out of a guy with it. Like, I'm thinking, this is weird. And I remember my dad thinking, oh, like, it was just different for us. And then I think it was Bubba who was, or Devon, they were right next to us with Public Enemy, and they were going at it. And I remember me looking at him and him looking at me like, where are we? We've never seen anything like it. But I don't know if you were at that show, but that show to me sticks out in my wrestling fandom.
I was not at that show, the first ECW show. And I used to go to ECW shows with my dad.
Wonderland?
I went to one Wonderland show. That was the night that Chris Candido's ear got torn off. When Van Damme and Sabu did the Rolling Thunder, Sabu had the spike in his boot, and it clipped Candido's ear.
I'll tell a quick Sabu story. We were at some con, a wrestling con, and I asked, of course, it's Sabu, you know, great history, and Sabu was an innovator and really someone who changed what wrestling could be, right? Like, he's someone who did, and kind of presenting my case to him, and he wasn't happy with the pitch, and he asked me who I wrote for, and I said Sports Illustrated, and he looked at me straight faced and said, never heard of it, and I didn't know how to respond to that. But we ended up doing the interview, I don't know, a few weeks later, and maybe he did a little research on Sports Illustrated. But I wanted to laugh because I thought it was a joke. Like, it never, not that you can't hear of SI, like, that's fine, but I just thought it was so funny. Said, never heard of it. And I was waiting for like a joke or something, and then it was like, this guy's not kidding with me. Either doesn't want to talk or doesn't know. So that's one of my favorite Sabu stories.
And Sabu is critically underrated for what he meant to the change in wrestling. Yeah. And he is, to my knowledge, like, he was the one who popularized breaking tables and doing all these weird dives, doing the springboard, putting a chair in the ring, doing a springboard onto the top rope, and then either doing a moonsault into the ring or diving out into the fans in the arena.
Probably didn't do himself a lot of favors with how he handled himself publicly with wrestlers, with media, with, you know, but I agree. It doesn't take away from his accomplishments.
No. And I was surprised that he only had like the 1 week ECW title run where he beats Terry Funk in the barbed wire match and then drops it to Shane Douglas, which I feel like was an accidental title switch, because that barbed wire match, like, I don't cringe on a lot of wrestling matches for like the sheer violence or the blood or anything like that. I'll cringe if it's somebody who I have some sort of personal attachment to, and I'll be like, like the Matt Hardy thing, that still bothers me. But I feel like that.
It's a good question. The next time I speak to Heyman, Jimmy, that's a great question.
Like, they got tangled up in the barbed wire, and it feels like they just couldn't get out. So Terry Funk is like, well, Sabu's in this position, beat me. And it was just called on the fly. It was just like, this is the situation, because ECW would have chaotic situations for changing shows. And so they changed their pay-per-view. That Born to be Wired match, I think they aired the title change. It would have been the Friday night on Channel 27 at 1 a.m. And the pay-per-view was that Sunday.
Don't you wish we were talking about, like, medicine or something relevant to society's well-being? Instead, we're like rattling off wrestling facts from 25 years ago, but it's fun.
I've had this conversation with people, and it's like, do I really want to talk politics right now? No, like, I get it. I get it. You want me to vote? Good. I'm going to vote like I do every year. I'm not one of the 47% of registered voters who didn't vote in 2016. Like, I can do that, but I feel like that's everywhere. So yeah. I'd rather just do the wrestling thing, and people can laugh, and, you know, you're hitting a niche audience, and because it's just more fun talking wrestling than it is the good and the bad of each party, each political party. I mean, I can do that. I can do that, but I'll leave that to Howie Carr. I'll leave that to Jerry Callahan. I'll leave that to, other people.
and we'll live in our domain. I'm with you. But I that's a great question for Paul Heyman. Next time I have the chance to speak with Paul, I'll ask, like, was that called on the fly? Cause yeah, another one of those cringeworthy moments. Not like this is incredible, but like, oh, and we were young then too, Jim. Sort of, I mean, you can appreciate put it in perspective when you can tell someone's in pain. It didn't look good.
No, it didn't. And the fact that I think I had the videotape of it, and I watched the match, and the match was okay, but I'm just like, I'm like uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
And I had already seen the finish because they had the finish on TV, but they spent more time showing the referees with the barbed wire gloves on with the wire cutters trying to cut them out than they did the actual match. I think they showed like two spots, and then they were tangled, and it's like, we got to end this thing because we can't do anything. And then they cut them out, and it probably was a little too far. Cause I don't remember them doing a barbed wire match after that.
Good point.
I think that was the last one that they did. Cause I remember when they did Cactus and the Sandman, they did a Sandman Raven one where Raven regained the title. And then they did Terry Funk and Sabu. And I don't think they did one after that, but they also went mainstream. They were more mainstream than that.
Tough to be mainstream with a barbed wire match and the man with Born to be Wired. You know what I mean? It's, you just can't please every master, especially when you're trying to be mainstream. Like, it would never work for WWE. I'm still surprised AEW went that route with Moxley and Omega. That match had some cringeworthy spots too, where it's just like, I don't want to see these guys get hurt. That's not why I watch.
Do you know, I in watching that live, I didn't have as much of an issue because my assumption was that Tony Khan did everything safely and did this, that, and the other thing with it to protect the town, because he's an NFL owner, so he knows about the concussion protocols. He knows about this, that. He's got the details where he would do that type of stuff and protect. And then, however many months later, the athletic commission fines him for using real barbed wire, for doing this, for doing that without their permission. I'm like, this kind of isn't like, so we're doing death matches now? Like, that's how we're going to get noticed?
Yeah, it's strange. Again, you can use, thankfully the guys weren't hurt. You can use that as a positive.
And we're doing unsafe death matches, I think is to clarify the point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an odd spot. Again, I think they can, fortunately for them, can turn that into their advantage when they revisit Omega Moxley. But in that match, they took a lot of chance. Those guys took a lot of chances and put their bodies on the line.
They did. I could do ECW forever. Right. The first one I went to was it was Terry Funk against Axel Rotten. It was a few weeks before. Oh, it was the only time I got to see Terry Funk live.
That was at Wonderland.
That was at it was the IBEW Hall in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's where I used to go with my dad, because I grew up in Newton, and Waltham was nice and easy. The only Revere show I went to was the one where Candido got his ear chopped off. Yeah. Which is a hell of a memory, right?
Yeah.
But those Waltham shows were great. And the only reason why they stopped using that venue is because the IBEW sold to a Buddhist temple. So the last show that they did was they main evented with New Jack's return to the Boston area, because New Jack had the mass transit incident where he bloodied up a 17-year-old kid who falsified his ID. And he wasn't allowed to work in Massachusetts. And then they brought him in as the surprise. I think he teamed with Axel and Balls Mahoney.
Place must have went nuts, Jim.
Oh, it did. It did. And they beat up the Dudley boys because they were great. Like, and actually, like, just to come full circle as we kind of wrap up here, because I've taken up enough of your time already. The Dudley boys, greatest tag team of my lifetime.
So how do you compare that with like the Road Warriors, for instance? And I'll save my choice for greatest tag team of all time, but how do you compare them with like the Road Warriors?
So I look at, and when I say my lifetime, I mean my wrestling lifetime. So that's WrestleMania 3, 87.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have caught the Road Warriors around the time that they had turned heel on the Midnight Express and had that run. Being a WWF guy, I was more into Demolition than I was the Road Warriors.
Yeah. And what a missed opportunity to do more with Demolition. I know Axe is on his way out, but what a missed opportunity to do more. But I don't think the Road Warriors, and they're probably my top pick, I just don't think they get enough credit for the end. Like, their last great thing they did was help put over Billy Gunn in Road Dogg, which doesn't sound that hard now, but those were two guys that just, they would get warm, but they couldn't get hot. And they finally struck gold together, but they were missing that last piece, that last component. And I thought Animal and Hawk, clearly, Jimmy, not at their peak anymore, but it was a very, very team player act to make sure that DX, particularly the New Age Outlaws, got to where they needed to be. I don't think LOD or the Warriors ever got enough, Road Warriors ever got enough credit for that. And two, you wonder how would LOD have aged had Hawk lived a little longer, and they could have done not another match, but they could have been highlighted at shows or done something like the Rock and Roll Express, where they come back and get that big ovation or that Road Warrior pop, if you will. But yeah, but the Dudleys certainly making, their relationship was longer than a lot of marriages, right? So you've got a good choice with the Dudleys there.
I think with the Road Warriors, and the point about them putting over the Outlaws is tremendous, because there were a few teams that got to touch the Road Warriors. And when I say touch them, like, I remember the Steiner brothers beat them on a back suplex where one of the Steiners rolls his shoulder up at a Starcade where they did the Iron Team tournament. And that was one of the few times that I remember the Road Warriors getting pinned cleanly. Right? Because they had the title switch with the referee and all that stuff. So then you fast forward, and WWF is just a totally different creature. But again, I was the Demolition guy because that was, you know, Axe and Smash come out at the Royal Rumble in 88. And I'm like, oh my God, it's the tag team champions. They're going head to head. Like, what's going to happen? And the Road Warriors, they never had that Hawk versus Animal match. There was a lethal lottery thing. And I think they didn't even get in the ring together. But I think with the fact that nobody had really touched the Road Warriors, that when the Outlaws beat them, destroyed them post-match, and then shaved off the head, shaved off their hair, like that was the, oh my God, somebody actually got to the Road Warriors.
And I think so much of that era, and they covered it on the documentary, Beyond the Ring.
Dark Side of the Ring.
Excuse me. And Dark Side of the Ring. Thank you. Which is a very good series. And they talked about I think what we remember mostly is the drunk angle or the storyline, yeah. which is brutal. Yeah. But like they did, they really, I don't think the New Age Outlaws are the New Age Outlaws without Hawk and Animal. You're right. Not many teams touched them or embarrassed them, right? Like they were really special.
Right. Yeah, because you think of when they lost the tag team titles, it was to the Varsity Club and it was on a crooked referee, which
right.
I love those crooked referee angles. I mean, the double Heppners is the best one of the bunch. I say the Dudleys because promo work, ring psychology, longevity, they did it on top with a bunch of different people.
Everyone.
I think that you know, they were the TLC matches, they're so important to that. Some work in New Japan, they did some work in TNA. Bubba Bully Ray was a world champion in the singles, you know, putting that whole Impact, you know, him, you know, me also calling him an average athlete aside, but
they were two guys thrown together in a big faction, like there were no big plans. Let alone for necessarily 5 years. Like the fact that the Dudley boys went on to the success they had probably even surprised them together. Like not that they couldn't have been successful, but the fact that they did it together, I think exceeded everyone's expectations, including their own.
Is that kind of one of those happenstance moments?
Absolutely. I mean, there were so many members of the family, the Dudleys, right? Like, but now all we know, I guess we know Spike. We really just know the WWE ones. So, you know, little Spike Dudley a little bit, but you know, Bubba and Devon and yeah, they had an incredible run. So if they're not the best of all time, I'll say the Road Warriors, but I'm with you. The Dudleys are right there too.
You know, I love the Steiner brothers as well. I have a special place in my heart for them, but
is the kid anywhere in the NFL, Jimmy? Rick's kid by the Ravens.
I don't know.
It's a matter of time before you see him on AEW Dark. It's just a matter of time. I know Jim Ross was interested, and I mean, there's so much you can do there with when your dad, or story-wise, your father's Rick Steiner, your uncle's Scott Steiner. Like, come on. Like, that's just bound to happen.
Yeah, I mean, wrestling has always been generational, so it makes sense if the kid's interested. Why not?
I think he wants to play out the NFL career first, but it depends on how far he can get. But the Ravens had interest.
That's probably smart.
Yeah, for sure, right? See what you can do. Wrestling will always be there. The NFL won't for him. So, yeah.
Justin, I have taken up enough of your time.
So much fun. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad that we could do this. I'm so happy for your success, and I'm happy about our friendship the last few years. I'm glad that we got to talk in front of a microphone.
And actually, you know, so see you too was fun too. Yeah,
I know the behind the music story is my computer camera had issues, so doing this a different way than the normal setup. So hopefully it comes out okay. But
Jimmy, I can't stress the friendship enough. I think even professionally, how you've always, and I've tried to on my end too, but different calls I've made with, you know, ridiculous questions. Hey, Jimmy, I gotta sit down with Pedro tomorrow. What's a different direction you think I should take? And you saying, Justin, you get a free minute and then give me 45. You know what I mean? Like little things like that. You don't forget. You shouldn't forget. And I never will. So it's so much fun to be on the show tonight. I'll highlight this in Wednesday's column. hopefully it's evergreen enough that, it lasts for a couple of days in the magical world of the World Wide Web. But
what's
coming up this week, Jim?
To do the Ask Conrad thing, I'll ask Justin, what's coming up on your story this week?
Thank you. Well, Monday we've got, I actually am really excited about this. And I was thinking it would be a Q&A, which I have no issue with Q&As, but that would be a Q. It's just important to have variety in your writing, especially when you're having different stories, multiple stories in a week. I thought it would be an Elias Q&A on Monday. His interview was just so dynamic, Jimmy. And there were a lot of things I didn't know about the Elias story, like especially the New Orleans WrestleMania, that story, the Cena story the next year at MetLife. So there's a lot. That'll be a feature on Monday. Wednesday will be every Wednesday is the Week in Wrestling column. The headline this week will be with Shotzi Blackheart, her rise in NXT. She's hosting Halloween Havoc next week. I'll talk a little bit. I'll write a little bit about my feeling, and I really like it, on the masked wrestler. It's just tricky when you're watching two masked wrestlers wrestle and you don't know either one. It'll be easier in future weeks when a certain wrestler wins. So you'll get used to seeing this wrestler work, and there'll be kind of a body of work behind it, where right now, if you're seeing just, you know, the guy with the green mask against the guy with the pink mask, it's sort of hard to figure out who's who. But I think that show has so much potential to highlight everything that's good about indie wrestling. And Jimmy, one that I'm really excited about, it'll be in the column on Wednesday as well, is an interview with Andre the Giant's daughter. And she,
oh,
Robin,
wow.
Her perspective on The Princess Bride and how her mom took her to the theater to watch. And this is 1987, and so a different world. And mom didn't tell her that her father was in it. So watching, and it's fairly early into the film when Andre appears, and if that's your dad, you're instantly going to notice. So kind of her giving her perspective on being the daughter of Andre the Giant, but also her love and admiration for The Princess Bride and what that meant to her father. And what a groundbreaking role. To me, the wrestler role is, I know he wasn't a megastar yet, but is the Thunder Lips role, like the Hogan and that type of muscle role, right? But Andre, like, I know he was the villain to open the movie, one of the bad guys, but like, he's so lovable and sweet, and he rhymes and he makes you laugh. And if you're an Andre fan, I hope you enjoy it.
I will. The Elias conversation I'm interested in, because I talked to Elias, or I walked with Elias maybe about a year ago. And I found him to be one of the more fascinating people to talk to off the air. The conversation I had with him was like 7-8 minutes. And I think he blatantly lied to me about something, because it was just so erroneous. So I had asked him about, like, you know, when WWE called, who called? And he said Vince called. And then he told me this story about, you know, Vince being very hands-on. And at the time he's telling me this, I'm like, I'm trying to follow it because I think he's working me, but I'm going to have fun with it anyway. And I'm thinking
about
it.
Was it the Mania in New Orleans story?
He did talk about the Mania in New Orleans story, yes. But then I think about it too, because
it wasn't Vince that called there, he said.
But it was Vince called Elias to sign him. And then it was all these details about working with Vince. And at the time, I'm like, oh, he's blowing smoke because Vince doesn't have time to do all this stuff. And then I think, like, if Vince finds a character, he finds the time to produce that character, hands-on produce that character, and be really involved with that character. So I go back and I'm like, he might not have been BSing me. He might have been telling me an actual real story, but because he was so quick with it, that I thought, oh, well, there's no way. Like, it had to have been Triple H or Mark Carano or somebody like that who called him. Not like, Vince isn't going to call the guy. But then, but it goes back and forth. And this is a way of saying, like, isn't wrestling weird?
You know, and I'm supposed to be talking about next week's stories. I got to mention a highlight of yours, too. We talked about John Moxley tonight. And I wanted to make this point earlier, Jimmy, when I was kind of writing down some thoughts before we went on, the air tonight. And I thought, you know, what an odd spot Moxley is to be champion in the pandemic. It's such an, you know, you're not traveling. It ripped away a lot of his momentum. I still think he's done a great job of representing AEW as their world champ in the face of their brand, right? Like, he's their champion. He's their guy. He was the champ, if you remember, right around the time of the brand split, which was, how do you strap a rocket to a guy when there's two rockets? Like, who's the champ?
And wasn't he accidental champ because Roman got popped for PEDs?
Let's talk about that. But he, if you remember, when he wins the belt, Seth Rollins wins. This doesn't get talked about enough. He got a great interview with no sleep from Vegas with you. That's one of your best, I think, wrestling. Like, you caught him on, you literally, I feel like he wasn't blowing smoke when he said, like, I still haven't slept. I think you got him on Monday, right? Like, and that was a great, that moment doesn't get enough credit, and it never will because he left WWE. But like, Seth Rollins and Roman work a great match. Rollins is finally back. Rollins wins. And then Ambrose cashes in after winning the Money in the Bank ladder match earlier in the night. That was a really good show and a fantastic finish. And that was one of the more fun interviews. I know we're already over time, Jimmy. What was the story?
No, we're fine. It's a podcast and we have as much time. I'm looking at the clock and I'm like, I've kept you long enough. We've just babbled for too long. So like, you know,
tell me that story though.
Okay. So Money in the Bank is that Sunday, and I get an email from T-Mobile Arena in Vegas, his shoot hometown.
Yeah,
and I get an email from WWE on Friday, and they ask, "Hey, would you be interested in talking to Dean Ambrose on Monday?" And I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely! Like, I'd love to do an interview with him, like, because I like him." I like the Dean Ambrose thing. I like the Shield thing. It just made sense. And I'm like, yeah, of course, I would love to. And I look at, like, if somebody's going to email me and be like, hey, would you like to talk to me or would you like to talk to this wrestler? Like, yeah, I can do that. Like, so yes, of course. So I remember saying to Billy Lanny after I get the email, Billy Lanny works with me on Felger and Ness. And he's a casual wrestling fan. He's a Brock Lesnar honk. And I said, I turned to him and I said, Dean Ambrose is winning Money in the Bank. And he goes, how do you know? And I'm like, WWE emailed me. They want me to talk to Ambrose on Monday. And so he actually wins Money in the Bank. And I'm like, and as I'm watching the show, he wins. And I'm like, he's going to win the title. And I'm going to talk to him tomorrow. This is awesome. And so I, cause it was on demand and I think I was a little tired, but I'm like, well, I'm going to stay up and watch the show. And it went over, usually the shows were like 3 hours at the time and it went over 3 hours. And so Ambrose wins the title and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to interview the WWE champion tomorrow. And I'm like a kid in a candy store. I'll have to go back and re-listen to that one because I also remember when I was recording it, I'm like, I don't know how Ambrose is with interviews, so I'm going to play this to story. And so I asked him a story question. He's like, oh, well, I think his answer was along the lines of, I'm just happy that I get to work with my brothers and we get to all feud over the title or something like that.
Right.
And I was like, oh, he's doing the real thing. Okay, we can go with this. But I remember just having fun with those 10 minutes because I was fully going into it being like, okay, here's the story. Here's what happened. And it's the day after he won the title. Like, this is super cool.
Hours after. And,
yeah. And then he's like, oh, well, I'm not in any sleep. I get to be in my own house after I won the title. I'm like, this is awesome. And it's just because I'm still 39. I'm still 39 and I'm still a fan. Like if we ever get to live events, you'll see me front row again, you know, jumping up and down when Charlotte wins the title. And, you know, 10 minutes later when Charlotte loses the title, my face is in the ground. Like I've just suffered this devastating loss because I did.
Jimmy, that got played on Felger and Maslow, if you remember. I think that was Felger talked about it or something. I remember them talking about it on the air. Like, I forget how it was mentioned. But I remember Mike Felger bringing it up, something to do with that interview. So I remember
So there was that, and TNR, Toucher and Rich, our morning show, spent an hour talking about it too. Like, they dissected it and did their thing. And it was a fun. You know what I'll do, Justin, is I probably have it on my computer hard drive. I might tag that on to the end of this.
Yeah, why not?
because it's a podcast. I think
he's a great interview. You know? Which is, again, like, you got to look at the Moxie story. Like, it's weird that for a guy who's a great interview, the Austin interview, you always got to go back to that and what happened. Because Austin's actually a pretty good interviewer, I think.
He's great.
Yeah. Moxie's a great interview, too. So what happened there in the Mania match? But it all adds to the intrigue of John Moxley.
Yeah, and I think, and maybe it was caused because of the pandemic, I feel like I've been expecting more out of this title run. And to me, it feels more like Moxley is Hogan against all these supervillain heels who are bigger than him.
So, which means he has to lose the belt for it to mean something again. Like, you have to. That's why I even thought McIntyre should have lost the belt to Orton. They had a window. It's now closed. I think now you just ride out with Drew. Like, Drew's your guy. You have AJ Styles. He needs to beat him in a feud. You have Sheamus. He needs to beat him in a feud. So you get a couple new faces on Raw that probably take you to, it's October, probably take you through the new year, right? I would think. You know, I don't know. So I don't know what you do there. That's a tough one. It's tough to be the babyface champion, look like Goliath. I mean, and it's hard. I thought Orton made the most of that. I thought they should have gave Randy a run, but I don't know. Obviously, Orton Edge will be fun when Edge is healthy again, too.
My move would have been Orton gets the title at SummerSlam. Otis loses the Money in the Bank contract to Miz. Miz cashes in on Orton, and Miz is the world champion for a while.
For a little while, maybe McIntyre, you know, beats Orton and then crushes Miz. I would, though, when he's healthy. Hey, guys get old, guys break down. When Edge is healthy, he needs to get his revenge on Randy Orton, obviously, but he needs to be the world champ. Like, that's a great story. That is textbook. He is the guy that I want as my WWE champion. That story writes itself. So I hope that when he's healthy again, we see a nice, you know, considerable run with the belt from Edge.
Well, here, let's play fantasy booker then. So Orton wins the title at Hell in a Cell. Edge comes back and is ready for Survivor Series. Edge gets Otis to get a match for Money in the Bank, and Edge gets the Money in the Bank briefcase, and everybody thinks he's going to cash in on Roman at some point, but he shows up on Raw and cashes in on Randy Orton. And then you can continue the story that way.
I don't mind the brand splits. I think if you're going to have them, you got to stick to them. But I do think when you have the briefcase, it's no rules, right? Like, you get the briefcase, you challenge. The idea is you challenge for any title. It should be a world title, because what are you doing if you're not? Otis is in a weird spot. Otis has no Tucker. He has no Mandy. So you really put this guy that was turning into a good act on his own. I wonder how he'll do in that spot. He's got the briefcase. For how much longer, we don't know. It just is odd they wouldn't keep him with Tucker. At the very least, Heavy Machinery is a good act together, right? Like, I know we're getting a lot of discussion about the New Day, you know, breaking up and different brands, and Big E's on SmackDown and Kofi and Woods are on Raw, which I'm not necessarily behind. But I think Heavy Machinery, Jim's that one just doesn't make sense to me.
I had always thought that the play for Otis was he wins the Money in the Bank, and then he gives it to Mandy Rose because he's in love. And Mandy then cashes in on the women's title and gets the women's title and then dumps Otis. But the problem with that is there's no payoff of a match, because the payoff is Otis getting revenge on Mandy, not revenge on whoever Mandy's with now, who I thought was going to be Dolph Ziggler.
Though you could have still done that and just had Mandy cash in and have them be happy that she won. I actually don't like the pairing with Dana Brooke. I after that SummerSlam match, I thought that was Mandy Rose's breakout moment. Like, that win against Sonya Deville was such a cool moment, such a good match. Like, I think she's ready for a title run. I think we need
to.
I know Asuka's the face of Raw right now, but and you've got a lot of talented women, but I think Mandy's ready for a title run. And how will you know if you don't do it? And it goes back. Certain people, I shouldn't say certain people, most wrestlers, they only have a window. Like, Braun, I think WWE missed out on that window. Punk, to go a few years back with that weird Triple H angle where he lost the Triple H, like that almost lost his momentum. Dean Ambrose too, another guy. If you remember, there was a roadblock. What was that show, Jim? It was a prior Mania show.
Yeah, he had the great match with Triple H.
Yep, and he lost that too. So it's like you never know when a guy's going to lose momentum, a person's going to lose momentum. Mandy is hot right now. I would capitalize upon that momentum and give her have her run with the belt on Raw. But yeah, I don't like pairing her with a tag partner, anybody really, right? Just have her be a single star.
Yeah, I think so too. But I think maybe having the romantic interest is a good way to get people emotionally invested, rather than this is the really attractive woman who's on my screen and oh, by the way, she can wrestle. And it also gets back to the emotional attachments that we have to performers, and we get that through promos, and we get that through the stories and things of that nature. So, but yeah, I'm big fan of Mandy Rose. I think Mandy Rose not only is one of the more talented and more beautiful women, I think she's a really good person too.
That's not, it's always nice when you add that to the mix. Yeah. I think she's very talented. I think that the Mandy Rose character deserves a run with the title, you know, Raw, SmackDown, whatever. She's on Raw now, but yeah, I wouldn't put her in the tag team with Dana Brooke. They could have paired them up in a program, but I actually liked Lana winning the Raw main event last week.
Oh, I loved it too, because nobody could call it. That's a Bruce Pritchard. Nobody will call this.
But I didn't love the fact that, like, give Lana the moment. Like, they didn't need to do Raw, Randy and Drew right after. Like, we get that feud is important. I think there's nobody's questioning the dislike between the two characters. But I'm with you. I that was a Bruce, like, kind of no one will see it coming. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we're both huge Conrad and Bruce fans. So, you know, just to really wrap up this time, I have learned more about wrestling listening to Conrad and Bruce talk about wrestling. And while I may not always agree with the direction, I at least have a better understanding as to why things are happening. And I think that has made me a better fan and maybe a smarter fan.
I'll be listening to the newest episode tonight. I'll watch the end of the Astros Rays, which I think is wrapping. And then I'll go straight to Bruce and Conrad. Fun little Saturday night.
Yeah. Their episode. I mean, their episodes are always great. They're available ad-free at adfreeshows.com.
I'm waiting for the next Kowloon trip, so for their next show. But those are always fun.
Yeah, yeah. We should hit up there sometime before long. But Justin, thank you so much for spending the last 2.5 hours dealing with me, because you know, not everybody likes dealing with me, and I understand that.
I'll say 2 thank yous. Thank you to you, Jim, for having me on. I appreciate it. And anyone that listened, I'm grateful to, you know, people listening, people reading. I'm at Justin Barrasso Twitter if you want to reach out and talk or have questions or want to read my work. I'm grateful. So thank you very much. And Jimmy, I really mean this. I can't wait till we do it again.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.